Good morning again. I invite you to turn to the Old Testament, to 1 Kings chapter 19. 1 Kings chapter 19. You know, when we think about the prophet Elijah, as I say that name, there are probably several stories that immediately come to your mind where God used Elijah to do some pretty amazing things. Like what this picture portrays, what happened at Mount Carmel, where the prophets of Baal were assembled to the mountain, and the king was there, all of Israel was there, and just Elijah was there as the representative of God, and he called down fire from heaven. He prayed to the Lord, and God answered him and burned up the sacrifice that he offered there, in contrast to what happened at the altar of Baal. We might think about how he called fire down on his enemies when he was sitting up on a hill and his enemies were trying to come and arrest him, and they just got torched because you don't mess with God's prophets. Or you might think about how Elijah left the earth, one of the only men in the history of the world to not die, that God just took him in this really dramatic kind of way. Elisha just looked over and there is his mentor flying up in a chariot of fire to the heavens to go be with God in eternity. I mean, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? But I'm really thankful that we have passages like the passage we're going to look at in 1 Kings 19 and a passage like Bradford just read for us in James chapter 5. Because James 5 says Elijah was not Superman. Elijah was a man with a nature like ours. When you think about some of these major Bible characters like Elijah, like Moses, like Joseph, like David, etc., you might think of them as guys who just are unlike any of the rest of us. But in reality, they were flesh and blood, just like you and I. They had personality quirks, just like you and I have personality quirks. You and I have struggles and issues. They had struggles and issues. Some of those we learn about in the pages of the Bible, and I'm sure there were many that we just don't read about. But we have enough of an indication from passages like this that they dealt with real stuff. That there were times in their lives, and Elijah in particular, where he goes through a valley and God leads him out the other side. But it's rough for Elijah for a while. He's discouraged. He's even depressed. And so 1 Kings 19 tells us about this dark period of his life and how God handled him. So today we're going to think about God's prescription for discouragement. Let's read this together, 1 Kings 19, and we'll talk about the context after we do that. 1 Kings 19, verse 1, Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and how he killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them," one of those prophets that just got killed, "by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid, and he arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I'm no better than my father's." And he lay down and slept under a broom tree. And behold, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you." And he arose and ate and drank, and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. There he came to a cave and lodged in it, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?"
He said, I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant. They've thrown down your altars. They've killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left. And they seek my life to take it away. And he said, go out and stand on the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sounds of a low whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak, and he went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? And he said, I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. And the Lord said to him, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu the son of Nimshi you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. And the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. So let's break this down in a couple of different ways. Let's talk about why Elijah is so downtrodden that he would actually ask God to kill him on the spot under this tree. And then let's think about what God does with him after his discouragement is fully seen here. So what is the context here? Well, if you back up into chapter 18, you notice that this is one of the places that should have been a high point in the history of God's people. Because what happens is, the princess of the Sidonians marries with the prince of the Israelites. Ahab has this marriage alliance with Sidon, and Jezebel becomes his spouse. And she is about the very worst thing that could have happened to Israel, because she brings in herself, and she's not a good woman at all. But she also brings in her religion. Over in Sidon, they worship Baal. Now guess what? Over in Israel, they're worshiping Baal now. And they're constructing a temple to Baal in Samaria. And they're making a big deal about this worship. Jezebel is very serious about her religion. And she's not serious about the religion of Yahweh. Even though, lip service is paid to Yahweh still, what she does is she hunts down and destroys every prophet of God that she can possibly find. And so what does God do about this situation? Well, as James mentions in the passage that Bradford read, Israel goes without rain for 3.5 years because one of the last prophets of God who's still around prays that God would withhold that rain. Now, why would he do that? Because Baal happens to be the Canaanite god of rain and fertility and crops growing. And so Elijah prays, God, please show these people that Baal is not the one who's in charge, that you are God. And so God does. And so all the rain disappears. About 3 years go by, and the Israelites have not done anything about this very clear sign that the God that they are worshiping is false and not true. And so Elijah wants to push the envelope, and so he says to Ahab, look, let's have a showdown. Okay, enough of this nonsense. You get your prophets together, I'll come as well, and we'll just see who's God. All right? And get all Israel there too. So everybody comes. Everybody shows up. And Elijah repairs the altar of God that was broken down.
And the prophets of Baal, 450 of them, they build up their altar too, and they go first, and they offer their sacrifice, and they yell out to Baal, and nothing happens. They even dance around and gash themselves till the blood is flowing out of their bodies. And nothing happens. Elijah's sitting there saying, hey, maybe he's in the bathroom. Like, maybe he went on a trip. I mean, yell louder, because he's a god. And nothing happens until they're thoroughly discouraged and defeated. And then he comes and he douses his altar with water. And there's not a lot of water left at this point, so that was really notable. He douses it several times. And then he calls out to Yahweh, and Yahweh answers by fire. And so Mount Carmel looked like the beginning of a massive change in Israel, because remember the people's reaction? They don't go, huh, look at that, that's something else. They all fall down on their faces, and they say, with at least with their lips, but not with their hearts, the Lord Yahweh, not Baal, the Lord, He is God, the Lord, He is God. And so, Elijah, can you imagine being Elijah at that moment? Yes! After 3.5 years, these people finally understand. And now we're going to get rid of the king and the queen, and now we're going to march over to the Temple of Baal and rip it down brick by brick. But none of that actually happens, right? Because after the people all say that, Ahab just goes home. And as chapter 19 picks up in what we just read, he goes home to sweet Jezebel, and he tells her all about what Elijah did. And Jezebel doesn't change. She doesn't send a message to Elijah and say, you know, this has really caused me to think about my life. You know, I think maybe it's time to make a change. Maybe the God of... She sends a messenger to Elijah, and she doubles down. And she says, you killed all my prophets? Well, guess what's going to happen to you if you remain in town? This is your invitation to leave. And so he does. Because he looks around, and nothing's changed. At least not on the surface. At least not on a grand, massive, national scale that he was hoping for. Because Ahab and Jezebel are still sitting on their thrones. And all the people, even though they did what they did at the mountain, they all go back home and they keep worshiping Baal. And so he's looking around thinking, well, what was this even for? Why did I even do this? Because nothing has been altered. If anything, it's just gotten worse. Because now they're on a manhunt for me. And so he runs out of town. The text even says there in chapter 19, he was afraid in verse 3 and arose after everything seemed to fall flat. Can you relate to this? You have a future in mind of how you expect your life to go, or the lives of the people around you that you care about, and the future doesn't turn out that way. And things that you put your hope in fall flat, and adjustments, sometimes severe adjustments, have to be made as you try to pick up the pieces and follow on with life, even though things are not going the way that you played them out in your mind. Maybe it was a person or a career or a spiritual project, and it just doesn't look like anything happens with it. That is the situation that this man finds himself in. This man with a nature like ours. So he does what maybe any of us would do if we were in that sort of situation. He's afraid. And so verse 3, he runs away. How could that happen though? He's a prophet of God. And he's done these powerful things. And he stood up on this mountain in front of the entire country. And he has called everybody to repentance. But even though he runs to Jezreel, by the way, chapter 18, Elijah gets so excited by what happened at the mountain that he is imbued with the supernatural speed of being able to outrun a man with a chariot to the city of Jezreel. But then nothing happens, and he runs from Jezreel almost as fast as he ran to it, there in verse 3. And there's that implication in the text from verse 2, from what Jezebel says, that that's exactly what she wanted to happen. And I think Elijah's afraid because he knows that so many of the prophets that were active are just no longer alive because God has delivered them into the hands of this woman. And she's killed a lot of the other ones. Remember when God pops up to him at the mountain of Horeb and says, "What are you doing here?" That's one of the foremost things on his mind in his response to God. Well, guess what, God? All the other prophets are dead. I mean, they're killed. And I alone am left. And I'm on their radar. They're trying to get to me. And so he becomes scared and he runs away. And I think all of us can relate to that feeling. And then I think a lot of us can relate to this too. Also in verse 3, you notice how he isolates himself from other people. So notice what the text says. He was afraid, so where does he go? He is called to be a prophet to the northern kingdom of Israel, but where does he go? He goes to the southern kingdom. In fact, he goes so much south that Beersheba, the city that's mentioned right there, is the southernmost city of Judah. But then he doesn't stop there. He goes even farther down, all the way down to Mount Sinai. So he is isolating himself from his northern Israelite brethren, who he's just, by this point, just absolutely fed up with. He's also isolating himself from his southern kingdom brethren, fellow Israelites. And also, did you notice in the text, he leaves his servant there in Beersheba. And by the way, I don't think this means that Elijah is some kind of rich guy that he can afford a servant. This is probably talking about a prophet in training. This trainee that Elijah just said, just stay here. I've got nothing to teach you anymore. Just stay here, and I'm going to keep going on the road. And so he goes down the road, and he goes into the wilderness by himself, and eventually makes his way all the way down to a very isolated spot that had a lot of significance in Israel's history. Have you ever been tempted to follow Elijah's example with isolation? Have you ever been tempted when something hits your life and just knocks the breath out of your spirit? What you want to do is kind of pull away from your immediate family members, spouse, kids, maybe pull away from your spiritual family members, pull away from even God himself sometimes. That's the kind of isolation that Elijah is wanting to do. I just want to get away from everybody else. And yet, the Bible teaches us that, even though we should have some time by ourselves in order to reconnect with God and pray. Remember, that's why Jesus would temporarily isolate himself and go off into the mountains or the fields or wherever he was to pray to his Father. He would always come back to his guys. But Elijah is not interested in that at all. He goes out and he just asks to die. Proverbs 18:1 says, "Whoever isolates himself seeks his own desire. He breaks out against all sound judgment." And from the way that Elijah sounds here, really, he's kind of in a mindset of just thinking about himself and his own personal situation and the frustrations and the loneliness that he feels himself. That's just on his mind. He's not really thinking about anything else. And that is sometimes our temptation as well. When we get discouraged for whatever reason, is to just want to get away. But fortunately, Elijah cannot isolate himself from the presence of God. Even though, verse 4, he is giving up on his job and on his life. Elijah doesn't see this as a temporary vacation, I'm just going to get away to Sinai for a little while, I'm going to camp out, I'm going to come back to my work. For Elijah, this is it. because he sits down and he says, God, please just kill me now. He goes to this barren wasteland, which matches the mood that he is in his mind and his heart. And he's not going to commit suicide. He's not going to go that far, but he does pray for death just like Moses did. He's in a pitiful state. He feels like a failure. He does. And he just wants to give up on it all. Are you tempted to do that sometimes? Just look at all the responsibilities that you have, all the work that God had put in front of you to do, and just think, enough of that. I'm tired of trying to teach people about Jesus. I'm tired of trying to live a godly life. I'm tired of trying to be faithful to Him. I'm tired of trying to work with other whatever it might be. Sometimes we face that moment of tiredness that he reflects here in this passage. And so what I want to do now is now switch to God's perspective. Because I think this is so interesting how God chooses to help Elijah. What does God do with a guy like this? What would you do with Elijah? Would you just say, man, you just need to buck up. You just need to get a grip. And you need to go back up there and do your job. Now, toward the very, very end of this text, God will remind Elijah, no, there's still work that I want you to do, and you need to go do it. But that's not where God starts with Elijah. Did you notice that? Where does he start with him? He cooks for him. Did you see that? God cooks for his tired, discouraged prophet, and then he just lets him sleep for a while. He sends an angel, and what does the angel say? I bring you good news? No. Get up and go back to Israel? No, not yet at any rate. You want to tell me what the problem is, Elijah? No. That's not the conversation. Instead, he just wakes him up and says, here's some food. It's nice food. You should eat it. And so Elijah does. And he does this two different times, and he sleeps a lot from that. So what do we learn from that? This is by no means the only part of this discussion when it comes to discouragement, but sometimes part of the picture of why we're discouraged is we're just physically worn out. And rest for the human body is just part of the natural rhythm that God gave us. That's why do you have to sleep every single day? Can you imagine how much more productive your life would be if you didn't need the 6 to 8 hours that most people need to have for normal operation? Can you imagine how much more productive the Israelites would have been if they didn't have to take every seventh day off and just rest from all their labors and not go out to the field and do the things that they want to do? Sure, more productive, but God is teaching them a principle here. You got to rest sometimes. And he makes us do that. He designs us that way so that we can rely more on him than we do ourselves. And so especially in times of discouragement, sometimes rest, somebody's touch, a hug at a needed moment, a good meal and a lot of sleeping in sometimes is what we need, at least at the beginning point. And when somebody is discouraged, it's not adequate to just look at them and say, you should be reading your Bible more, you should be praying more. Now, maybe that is true. Maybe that is good advice for their situation, depending on what they're doing or not doing. But that is not the sum total of the issue. Sometimes you need to tell some people you need to slow down and you need to reflect and you need to rest and you need to sleep and you need to eat. Perhaps that should be our starting place sometimes with our own discouragement and sometimes with the discouragement of others. But obviously that's not the only thing that this text is talking about. Something else that God does with Elijah, you notice from chapter 19, is he questions him and he listens to him. Why does Elijah go to Mount Sinai? You ever thought about that? Why Mount Sinai, of all places? I mean, he goes a great length to get there. And he travels 40 days and 40 nights, which, by the way, is a time frame that is pregnant with meaning, as D. Bowman would say.
There's a lot of significance to 40 days and 40 nights, which we won't go into. But he goes all the way down there. Well, that is the place where God revealed himself. Where God came down and showed himself and spoke to the people. So it's almost as if, and obviously I don't know what all is going on in Elijah's mind right now, but it's almost like he's craving this extra connection with God. You know, you showed yourself here, now I want to see you now. And he goes to a cave here, maybe the very same cave, for all I know, that Moses went into when Moses said, I want to see your glory. And he got hid in the cleft of the rock, and God passed by. Notice God is passing by here in this text as well, from the cave. And Moses was able to see the back of God, even though he couldn't see his front, couldn't see his full glory. There's almost this sense from Elijah that I'm missing you. I want to see you. And so he goes to this place, and God asks him this question. And not because God is completely surprised by this, or God just has no idea why Elijah is there, but he wants Elijah to verbalize the issue, to speak about the problem. And sometimes when we're discouraged, that's what we need. We need somebody to be our ear. We need somebody to listen to the problems that are weighing down on our backs, our shoulders, and most of all, we need to verbalize those things to God himself, because he's actually the one who can do something about those things, unlike the people around us who can offer encouragement and sympathy, but sometimes not much else. Elijah doesn't hold back. You know, there's almost a hint of accusation here in the text. Did you pick up on that? That all of these things have been happening up north, God. And between the lines, there's almost this question of, and where were you? Where were you? You know, I've been up there slaving away, teaching a hard-hearted people your message, and the thanks I get is they're killing all my brother prophets, and I'm the only one left. And now they're going after me like they did everybody else. And Jezebel is still on the throne. It's almost like, if we put this in sports terms, it would almost be like saying, look, it's the fourth quarter, and there's 3 seconds left on the clock, and I gave you the ball, and you fumbled it at the goal line. I mean, the Lord, he is God, the Lord, he is God, and then nothing happens? Really? So Elijah is just having a really hard time wrapping his head around that. Sometimes we go through things that we have a hard time understanding, and we need somebody to listen to us. And so you need to be that ear for your brother or your sister, if that's what is needed at that moment. And you need to take them to God, because this is what God does with people. Notice what God does also. God shows Elijah that he cannot be put in a box. Notice how God reveals himself. So it's like, you know, Elijah comes and says, God, I want to see you. And so God said, okay, you want to see me? Well, here's some things that I am not in. And so there's this dramatic scene of this wind and this earthquake and this fire. But the text carefully points out that the Lord is not in those big dramatic things. Instead, there's the sound of a low whisper or a still small voice. Maybe some of your translations might say. And that's when Elijah goes to the mouth of the cave and then has this next discussion with God, where he gets his next marching orders and God questions him again. But I think this is a point that God's making throughout all of that is, I can work in the big dramatic moments, like Mount Carmel, like fire coming down from the sky, like, you know, showing my glory and power that way. But that's not always how I work. You know, and so just because things didn't go the way you expected them to at the mountain doesn't mean that I had my hands off the wheel. You know, what I'm going to work through, the way I'm going to take down Baal is not really through Mount Carmel. That was just the starting point. The way I'm going to take down Baal is you're going to go back up there and you're going to anoint people who are going to take out Baal.
You know, Elisha and Jehu and this king of Syria, who's not even an Israelite. I mean, all of those guys are going to be my chosen instruments, but that's going to be not the way everybody's going to expect it to be. And that's something that we need to learn about God, is just because He doesn't choose to work in the big moments that we think He should work in the plans that we have, in the way that He... that we think He should go in, it doesn't mean He's not working. It just means that we don't know how He's working, or He's working in these quiet ways to accomplish His will, because isn't that His preferred method? To take the weak and the silent and the mute and the helpless and to put instruments in their hands so that they can show His magnificence, because nobody would have expected that. That's why the cross is so powerful. Nobody would have expected that we would be saved and delivered from the powers of darkness by a naked man who had his back shredded and was nailed to a piece of wood while his enemies laughed at him from below. Nobody would have expected that. Least of all the devil. And so we put him there, not knowing that that was God's chosen instrument. Because we can't put God in a box. God is working. He's doing all kinds of things that you and I are not aware of. In our lives and other people's lives around us, we have to take consolation from that and assume that God is working through us even when we're discouraged. And then finally, he gave him a job to do. Notice this, how God responds to Elijah's speech. He doesn't say, "Oh, yeah, you know, you really have had a rough time. You poor guy. I mean, yeah, they've been hunting you down and all that." He doesn't say anything about that. He says, "Okay, I hear you, but now you need to leave the cave. Now you need to go. And you need to go back to where you ran from, and you need to do some work that I have for you to do. Baal worship is going to be taken care of. It's not going to happen overnight, but it is going to happen through the swords of these men." Sometimes the best thing for us to do when we're discouraged is to not slacken our hands from the work of God, but instead to push forward with more zeal to the work of God, whatever He has for us to do. President Theodore Roosevelt, and some of you may know this, he lost his first wife and his mother on the exact same day when he was a young man. And about that time of his life, he started to really get serious about politics and all kinds of other things in his life. He sought activity because what he said was, and I really like this quote, "Black care rarely sits behind a rider whose pace is fast enough." And I think it's interesting to apply that idea to the work of God. Is, yeah, do you have discouragement? Do you have things that smack you in the face? Sure, you do, I do, but the way to handle that is to latch on even more securely to whatever it is that God wants you to do and to push forward with greater zeal. That's what he told Elijah. And what he did was, at the very last part of this, he put Elijah's life into this larger perspective. And I love the way he handles this. He says, "You think you're by yourself? You think you're alone?" And by the way, when we're discouraged and we're isolated and we feel lonely, do we not feel alone? "Well, I'm the only one who sees this, or I'm the only one who's doing that, or I'm the only one who's serving the Lord in this way, and nobody understands and knows my situation." God says, "No, that's not the right way to frame this in your mind. There are 7,000 others who haven't bowed the knee to Baal, have not kissed him." And I don't know if that is a literal number of 7,000 or if that's just a symbolic number, but regardless of which one it is, he's making the point that there are more of you than just you. And so it is always important for us to remember that in a congregation we don't understand what everybody else is all doing at the same time, in terms of our work with each other, in terms of our work in the United States, to not think, well, our church is the only one that's doing this here. There are other churches, there are other good-hearted Christians in so many other places in this land and in other lands scattered across the globe who are facing the exact same trials and situations that you and I are. And they're having to latch on to God just like you and me. We're not the only ones in anything, in any possible way that we could try to frame that as, it's just me, it's not just me, and it's not just you. And the sooner we grab hold of that idea, the better off we're going to be when it comes to discouragement. What Elijah was shown is that God was not stopping his work at Mount Carmel. He was just revving it up. And there wouldn't be a climactic moment again like that until finally Jehu comes and becomes king over Israel and overthrows the throne of Ahab and Jezebel. But that wouldn't be for years down the road. But the temple of Baal would be taken care of, and all the prophets and all the worshippers of Baal would be slaughtered, and the temple of Baal would be turned into a sewer, a latrine, a disgusting, defiled place that nobody would ever worship any god there ever again. God is working, but his timetable is not ours. The way he works is not the way we think he should work. We just need to trust him. And that seems trite to say, we just need to trust God. But when you understand the weight behind that, it's not trite. He has good reason to expect us to just say, you're God, I'm me, and you can do with me what you want to. And you might lead me through the valley of the shadow of death. You might lead me through paths that I would really rather not trod on. You might, make me feel as though I'm the only one. But in reality, we all need to realize that we're not. And that someday, that faith is going to become sight. And we will be around the throne of God in the presence of everybody else, including Elijah himself. We're gonna meet this guy someday, y'all. And we're going to join him in a spirit of brotherhood, because we'll have been through the same thing. Not in the exact same ways, not with the exact same work, but as the people of God who faced discouragement and pushed through it to get to God. That's the invitation of this text. Right? And so if you're discouraged right now in your life, if you have an Elijah moment right now, and you are facing a trough, you are facing a valley, you are facing something that's smacking you in the face, if it's because of your sins, if it's because you have blemishes on your soul that need to be taken care of, you can exit that valley today. You can get out of that this moment if you come to Jesus and you tell him, I need your cleansing and your power. And because nobody else can help me with that, and I certainly can't myself. And so if we can take you to the water after hearing your commitment, your confession that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and the only one that can save you and wash your sins away, You sign up for his cause, we can baptize you today, or we can study with you, we can pray with you, we can try our best to help bring you to this Jesus who can help you in a way that nobody else can. And so if you want to respond to the gospel message today, please let us know how we can serve your situation. As together we stand up and we sing the invitation song.